Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is the famous Hungarian Dance No. 5 by Johannes Brahms, performed here by the Budapest Festival Orchestra. This is an example of a composition based on or heavily influenced by folk music. It's from a set of 21 dances that Brahms wrote, many of them based on actual Hungarian folk tunes, or at the very least influenced by such melodies. Folk music has had a huge impact on the fine art music of the last several centuries. And in this episode, we will explore the impact folk music has had on composers throughout music history. In our segment, Sounds of Scripture, we will explore the rich folk culture of the ancient Hebrews. For our classroom corner, we will talk about the massive role folk music plays in music education. And for our segment, Backstage Banter, I sit down with two musicians from the internationally acclaimed folk band Horseshoe Road, Kyle Dillingham and Peter Marcus, trained in both folk and classical styles, and how they blend the two in their performances. Today on Music for Life, the folk element. What is folk music? According to Dictionary.com, it is music usually of simple character and anonymous authorship, handed down among the common people by oral tradition. Encyclopedia Britannica adds, it is functional in the sense that it is associated with other activities, and it is primarily rural in origin. The term folk music and its equivalents in other languages, the Encyclopedia Britannica says, denote many different kinds of music. The meaning of the term varies according to the part of the world, social class, and period of history. In determining whether a song or piece of music is folk music, most performers, participants, and enthusiasts would probably agree on certain criteria derived from patterns of transmission, social function, origins, and performance. That was a quote from Encyclopedia Britannica. Another definition is any style of music which represents a community and can be sung/played by people who may or may not actually be trained musicians using the instruments available to them. Now, I would add that some folk music takes a tremendous amount of training to perform. Bluegrass comes to mind. Nowadays, folk music usually is synonymous with world music, for those of you wondering what that category is in the music stores. This particular element of music has had a huge impact on composers throughout what we call standard music history the last 350 years or so, but especially the last 200 years. Composers often would write a piece of concert music patterned after the song and dance style of a particular folk culture, either using their own, perhaps for some patriotic reason, a way to keep their own native culture alive in their music, or as an homage to a distant culture, evoking images of that faraway land. There are just so many examples of this. Like I alluded to a moment ago, it's more common from the Romantic era through the present, but there are examples from the Baroque and classical eras as well. Before we do that, let's get into our first segment, Sounds of Scripture, where we survey the Bible's many references to music to explore what ancient music was like. It's important not to confine our discussion of history to just the last 350 years. Folk music goes back even into biblical times. In fact, music in this time period was more pervasive within certain cultures, particularly the Hebrew culture. Nowadays, with the advent of modern technology, we tend to reserve music for the specialized few, listening to recordings of others rather than singing or performing it ourselves. But in the Israelite culture, music was a huge portion of their everyday lives. Suzanne Eich von Thurah, in her seminal work Music of the Bible Revealed, wrote this: music, it seems, was a highly developed art in the land of Canaan, the Hebrews, being themselves born musicians, were impregnated by it, she says. She writes, "This much we can deduce. If this is not so, then how, after the incessant trials the people experienced, could King David have brought together 4,000 Levites with aptitudes for vocal and instrumental music, where he founded a veritable academy of sacerdotal music for the divine service?" Thinking of David, one can imagine the folk-type ballads he composed and performed while a young man tending his father's sheep. In a previous episode, I discussed an archaeological find that showed a rich folk culture in Israel, particularly among the tribe of Dan. A terracotta relief was found in the region of the Promised Land where the tribe of Dan had settled. This artifact, known as the Dan Dancer, dates back to the 15th century BC, when Joshua was settling Israel's tribes in their new land. The posture of the figure, playing the lute, possibly wearing a mask, and lifting a leg, indicates at the very least a culture that used music not just for religious purposes, but as a way to entertain. The Book of Psalms contains several possible elements of folk influence. The inscriptions of two psalms each contain a unique Hebrew phrase, Psalm 56 and Psalm 22. Psalm 56 is inscribed to the chief musician upon Yonath Elemrechokim. This Hebrew word, which the King James Version translators don't even translate, literally means on the silent dove of the far-off pine grove. A similarly unique phrase is found in Psalm 22, another psalm of David, which is inscribed to the chief musician upon Ayaleth Shahar. Again, a Hebrew phrase, untranslated, literally meaning of the doe at daybreak. Alfred Sendri, in his book Music in Ancient Israel, believes the most logical explanation is that this evoked the tune of a folk song or melody the words were to be sung to. Now, this explanation assumes that the text and melody were not inspired simultaneously, as Susan Eichvantura believes they were. She believes them to be special instruments on which these psalms were to be performed, though they are not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. It may very well just be a performance marking, like a tempo or style marking, or a dedication that has little to do with any folk melodies or a type of instrument. But still, it's interesting to consider those perspectives. Another psalm that references the rich musical culture, which would also imply a rich folk music culture, is Psalm 137. "By the rivers of Babylon," it reads, "the Babylonians required of their captives a song. Sing us one of the songs of Zion," it reads in verse 3. "But the captives said they hung their harps on the willow tree and said, 'How shall we sing the eternal song in a strange land?'" So the music of their land didn't fit into the Babylonian cultural landscape as they saw it. The psalmist for Psalm 137, likely a historian familiar with the captivity, perhaps Ezra, indicates the music was silenced in captivity and possibly even why God silenced it. "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy." Those verses there in Psalm 137 are the words of musicians. They are saying it is better to forget the skill of your hands on an instrument than it is to forget Jerusalem, that it is better for your tongue to stick to the roof of your mouth, making singing impossible, than it is to relegate Jerusalem to less than your chief joy. So they hung their lyres on the willow branches because they knew they didn't have their focus right on Jerusalem. Even the word prefer in verse 6 refers to ascending to Jerusalem. Perhaps many in Judah were caught up in their own music and not looking to the example of the national headquarters, or not visiting it, not ascending to it. This brings up another set of psalms that may have had a folk-type function, in that they were possibly meant to be songs of pilgrimage as people made the ascent into Jerusalem. Isaiah speaks of a future utopian time when people will come to Jerusalem after a bitter captivity and come to Zion with songs, he says, and everlasting joy upon their heads. That's in Isaiah 35, verse 10. They come singing songs along the way, and they are ascending into Jerusalem. The 15 psalms that comprise Psalm 120 through Psalm 134 are called Songs of Degrees in the English translation found in the King James Version. But the Hebrew word for degrees literally means ascents, as in ascending. And that's how some translations render it. And some believe that these were songs to be sung as people made the ascent into Jerusalem. The Hebrew ma'ala actually means steps, stairs, or ascending. The root ala is used frequently in the Bible to refer to the trek to Jerusalem, as it existed at a higher geographic elevation than other parts of the region, and the temple was situated on higher ground. Jesus' parents went to Passover each year in Jerusalem, Luke 2 verse 41 tells us. Luke's account says they went up every year. Later in Luke, he comments how Christ was ascending up to Jerusalem in Luke 19:28. Alfred Sendri writes, "Thus Shir HaMa'alah would simply imply Song of the Ascending Pilgrims or Songs of Pilgrimage." Sendri writes, "The contents of these short popular songs are indeed very appropriate for the occasion, some of them even containing direct allusions to pilgrimage, like Psalm 121, 122, 132, 133. These would have then, these are my words, a folk function." Now, not all of these psalms are about traveling, but those that are not are about looking to Jerusalem, Zion, the temple, or even heavenly headquarters. Some believe the songs were written to be, as Alfred Sendri writes, psalms sung by the repatriates from the Babylonian captivity when they ascended to Jerusalem. He writes, "Indeed, Ezra called the return from Babylon, Ham'alah mi Babel." Sendri's comment on Ezra's phrase, "go up from Babylon to Jerusalem," could connect these psalms with this moment in history. He continues, "The expounders try to elucidate this particularly by referring to the historical fact that the return from Babylonia took place in successive groups as if by degrees, first under Zerubbabel in 537, Ezra 2:2, and then in the seventh year of the reign of Artaxerxes under Ezra in 458, Ezra 7 verses 6 to 8. That's a quote from Alfred Sendri. And as we know, Nehemiah came at another stage. So those could be the degrees or the steps or the stages returning back to Jerusalem from that particular captivity. Psalm 122, "I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord." That psalm refers specifically to the tribes that will go up to Jerusalem. The phrase for "go up" in verse 3 is the root word for ma'ala and the songs of ma'alot, or the songs of degrees, or the songs of ascents. What's more, Jerusalem is prophesied here to be even higher in elevation after the Messiah's feet stand on the Mount of Olives, which is referred to in Zechariah 14, verses 4 to 5, which causes a topographical restructuring. And then many will go up, it says, to keep the feast from year to year in Jerusalem. That's found in Zechariah. Isaiah and Micah say the mountain of God's house will be established in the top of the mountains and exalted above the hills, and people will have to go up to the mountain of the Lord. So these songs, many of them about peace and abundance, which is how the time of the Messiah's rule is described elsewhere in the Bible, would be highly appropriate songs, much like folk songs, for all people to sing as they ascend into Jerusalem. This has been Sounds of Scripture.
I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord. Our feet shall stand within your gates, O Jerusalem, 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 restored, one united whole. Here the tribes assemble to praise and thank the Lord. Jerusalem, our own, here are set the thrones of the house of David. Here the seeds of peace are sown.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are discussing the folk element. We are exploring the impact folk music has had on composers throughout music history. let's talk about the influence of the folk element in the Baroque era, the mid-17th to mid-18th century, basically. In other episodes, I've referenced the Baroque suite, an instrumental piece that's a grouping of dances that come from a variety of European cultures, as they are known in French, since France was the cultural hub of the Western world at this time. The first movement of every suite, if there isn't a prelude or an overture, is the allemande. This is the French word for German, implying some sort of German dance meter from which it was derived. The last movement of nearly every suite is gigue, the French word for the Irish folk dance known as the jig. Sometimes it would include dances that had their roots in folk traditions like the beret, rooted in a French clog dance, the gavotte, another French folk dance, or the polonaise, the French word for Polish, and this was a folk dance of Poland. These suite movements are so short, I want to give you an example of a few of these. The most famous Baroque suites might be George Frideric Handel's Water Music Suites. These were written for King George I's large party out on London's Thames River, so obviously music inspired by these folk dances was finding its way into the royal courts of the Baroque era. Here is the beret from Water Music Suite No. 2 in D, performed by the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. I always think of the pun delivered by Kelsey Grammer, playing the fictional character Fraser Crane, who tells his brother Niles about the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Nobody handles Handel like Orpheus handles Handel. So here is the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra performing Handel's Water Music Suite No. 2, the beret movement. That was the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra performing Beret from Handel's Water Music Suite No. 2. We are talking today on Music for Life about the folk element in fine art music. The beret, what we just heard, was rooted in a French clog dance. Another dance from the Baroque suite that I mentioned earlier was the gavotte, rooted in a folk dance from southeast France. Here's a famous gavotte from Bach's Violin Partita No. 3 in E. Partita is just another name for a suite, usually implying a suite for a solo instrument. Here it is performed by Itzhak Perlman. Thank you. Itzhak Perlman performed Bach's Violin Partita No. 3 in E. That was the gavotte movement. A gavotte was a French folk dance. Compositions based on the gavotte meter were often included in suites written in the Baroque era. We are talking about the folk element in fine art music on today's episode of Music for Life. As I mentioned earlier, the Baroque suite almost always ended with a gig, based on the Irish folk dance, the jig. But I won't play a complete example of that in today's episode. I want to save that for an episode where we will dwell entirely on the Celtic influence, the Irish and Scottish folk influence, on music history. I also referenced a polonaise. Again, that's the French word for Polish, and it was a Polish folk dance in a three-beat pattern. Not as fast as a minuet or the waltz to come later, but a slower or stately three-beat pattern. One, two, three, one, two, three. But I'll wait till we start talking about a famous Polish composer who wrote a slew of these for the piano. So we'll listen to a polonaise then. As we move into the classical era, these composers were also influenced by the folk elements around them. Probably the most famous example can be found in the last movement of a piano sonata by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The last movement of his Sonata No. 11 is marked Alla Turca, or in a Turkish style. Sometimes it's called Turkish March, or Turkish Rondo, or Rondo alla Turca. Now, don't let the rondo confuse you. Rondo refers to a musical form or structure. It's where there's a main theme presented, then a contrasting theme, then the main theme returns again, and then another contrasting theme is presented, then back to the main theme. We usually use letters when analyzing the form of a piece of music, so this form would usually be rendered A, B, A, C, A, or A theme, B theme, A theme, C theme, A theme. There are several variants of the rondo form, and this movement is based on one of those variants, so it's not as easy to follow as A, B, A, C, A, but what I want to focus on is the Turkish element, the alla Turca. Now, Turkish didn't mean then what it means today, as we would think music of Turkey. It was based on the marches of the Ottoman Turks, an empire that spanned far more than just Turkey, and an empire which had at this time stopped posing a serious threat to the Austrian Empire. And the sounds of these marches favored percussion instruments like triangles, cymbals, and bass drums. Composers would have invoked this style to give their music a certain exoticism. And as you might expect, it often had a march-like quality because of those percussive elements. Mozart used this style throughout one of his operas as the whole plot involves Turks. Haydn also used Turkish music in his Symphony No. 100, nicknamed the Military Symphony. And Beethoven wrote a Turkish march in some incidental music he wrote, that's music used to accompany a play, which he later arranged for the piano. So let's continue listening now to the remainder of this last movement of Mozart's Sonata No. 11 in A, Mitsuko Uchida, pianist. Thank you. So that was an example of the military music of the Ottoman Turks being used by composers to evoke the idea of this foreign-sounding or exotic folk culture. The Turkish marches had more percussion than the typical classical orchestra, and in this case, here was a piano piece based on this style. So there was no percussion at all, but you could hear the piano imitating those percussive qualities of this Turkish music. Let's hear one more brief example of Turkish-inspired music. Beethoven used this folk style in a section of his Ninth Symphony, the final and most famous movement. You hear the extra use of percussion, which gives it that exotic style. And then it transitions back to the main Ode to Joy theme that we are all familiar with. So here is just that section, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra under the baton of Herbert von Karajan. Thank you. So that was just a segment of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, performed by Herbert von Karajan and the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, and the earlier part of that section that I played uses a Turkish march style with its various percussion instruments. You heard the cymbals and the triangle. It gives the piece a folk quality, evoking the idea of music from the Ottoman Empire, which was quite foreign to the Austrian culture of that time. And we're talking about the folk element and the folk influence on Fine Art Music in today's Music for Life episode. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Not long after Beethoven, we come to a Romantic era composer who made extensive use of the folk styles of his native land. He translated these styles into the many piano pieces he wrote. This composer wrote almost exclusively for the piano. His name was Frédéric Chopin, and he lived from 1810 to 1849. I've mentioned on this show before how I teach a music appreciation class here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. This campus is also home to a kindergarten through 12th grade institution known as Imperial Academy of Edmund, and there I've taught the general music class since its inception in 2008. Every month at Imperial Academy, we have a composer of the month, and in the general music class, I go over examples from these composers, I go over a lot of the history about the music that they wrote, and sometimes, if this is available, I'll read a biography aimed at children about the composer. Mike Venezia wrote a series of biographies called Getting to Know the World's Greatest Composers, and I read this one about Frédéric Chopin. I have it right here. And I'm just going to read a little bit of this section here. It says, Chopin's teenage years were very important. He was getting his ideas together on how he felt about his country, his music, and his future. He especially learned a lot from going on summer vacations with his family. In the countryside of Poland, Frédéric Chopin saw the hard-working Polish peasants and heard their music. People had been singing and dancing to this music for hundreds of years. Frédéric got lots of ideas for his own music from these trips. One popular folk dance Frédéric learned about was the mazurka. The music for this dance can be lively and exciting or sweetly sad. It was an important part of the lives of Polish peasants. People felt proud of their homeland when they heard and danced mazurkas. They knew they had something of their own that even a bossy czar couldn't take from them. He's talking in this book about how Russia was always bossing Poland around and taking parts of its land and taking things from it. But then he makes the point that the folk music and the folk dancing of this culture was something that no dictator of any neighboring country could take from them. In these books, he has some cartoons that he draws to sort of illustrate some of these points. And he has a message from someone from Russia talking to the peasants saying, the Tsar demands from each family the following, 2 chickens, 1 pig, 3 ducks, a sack of flour, and 4 mazurkas. And I read that to the kids and they all giggle at that because it's funny to think of someone trying to take the mazurkas from the Polish peasants because it was something that was part of them in their spirit. It wasn't something that you could take away that was tangible. So Frédéric Chopin had this love for these Polish dances, the mazurka being one of them. It says Frédéric Chopin ended up composing more than 50 of his own mazurkas. He added his own special touches, and mazurkas became some of his most popular works. Chopin's mazurka in B-flat major, Opus 7, number 1, is a good example of how he captured the spirit, fun, and excitement of Polish life in his music. And so let's listen to Artur Rubinstein performing Chopin's B-flat major mazurka, Opus 7, number 1. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. This is KPCG. Today on this show, we are exploring the folk element, folk music's influence on the classical or fine art repertoire. We've been talking about the Romantic era and the composer Chopin, who was heavily influenced by the Polish folk culture, the mazurkas that he wrote, over 50 of them. That was one of them, Opus 7, number 1 in B-flat major, performed by Artur Rubinstein. Another Polish dance, referenced earlier, it was part of the suites written back in the Baroque era. It was called the Polonaise, which is the French word for Polish. And Chopin wrote several of these as well. These are grand piano pieces that he wrote. The most famous is the Polonaise nicknamed Heroic. So here is the Heroic Polonaise, and I'd like you to listen to the rondo form of this particular piece. It starts out with an introduction, and then when this theme comes in, this is the A theme. And then when this theme comes in, this is the B theme. And then it returns back to the A theme. And then you hear this theme, the C theme. And then finally it returns back to the A theme, and then there's a final section known as the coda, or the tail end of the piece. So here it is performed by Yevgeny Kissin. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. That was Yevgeny Kissin playing Chopin's Heroic Polonaise. Chopin wrote several of these grand pieces for the piano based on the Polish dance known as the Polonaise, a stately 3-beat-per-bar dance. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Another composer from the Romantic era who drew a lot of influence from the folk cultures around him was Johannes Brahms, who we talked about at the beginning of this episode. His famous Hungarian dances were based on Hungarian folk tunes. Most of them were, some of them were just heavily inspired by Hungarian folk tunes. We heard a little of his most famous dance, number 5. Let's hear just a portion of his Hungarian dance, number 6. This is arranged for and performed by the Eroica Trio, a trio consisting of violin, cello, and piano. You are listening to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Our episode today is discussing the folk element, where we are exploring the impact folk music has had on composers throughout music history. That was Brahms' Hungarian Dance No. 6, performed by the Eroica Trio. It's one of 21 Hungarian dances that he wrote, based on Hungarian folk tunes or heavily inspired by the Hungarian folk tradition. Another composer who wrote a set of famous pieces based on folk dances of his region was the Czech composer Antonín Dvořák. He was inspired by Johannes Brahms' Hungarian dances, but Dvorak didn't draw from folk tunes as much as Brahms did. The melodies are all Dvorak's. However, he based these pieces more on the rhythms of the Slavonic or Slavic folk dances. And we're listening to a less peppy Slavonic dance here. This is Opus 72, number 2, performed by Seiji Ozawa with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, with soloists Yo-Yo Ma on the cello and Yitzhak Perlman on the violin. ¶¶ So we are exploring the impact that folk music and folk culture has had on composers throughout music history. Dvorak wrote a set of 16 Slavonic dances following the pattern set by Brahms' Hungarian dances. Dvorak's set was based on various Slavic dance rhythms, but what Dvorak was most known for was a piece of music that he wrote inspired by an entirely different folk culture. And we'll talk about that when we come back. We also have the segment Classroom Corner, where we'll talk about the tremendous influence that folk music has had on music education. And then we have an edition of Backstage Banter, where we talk with some classically trained folk musicians to see how performers are incorporating the folk element in their classical playing and the classical element in their folk playing. We'll be right back.